Voters in the town of Munster will be asked soon to show their support for what may be two referenda and a special election coming up this spring that will help the school town of Munster. And we have with us to talk about it the superintendent of the school town of Munster, Dr. Jeff Hendricks. Dr. Hendricks, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
Please take a moment or so and explain what the referenda, and one in particular, which we know has been preliminarily approved by the Lake County Board of Elections. This is the one that deals with the construction and renovation work that the school district is looking for. Talk about that, because that's the big one. That's one that was seeking the most money, I understand.
Yes, Chris, we are looking at this capital projects referendum, which we'll be focusing on all five of our buildings, including a piece also to increase funding to our technology program as well. And what we're looking at, a lot of these areas that we're going to focus on include the infrastructure within each building, heating and air conditioning systems. We're talking about the learning environments. We're looking at roofing, parking lots. We've got security systems that we're trying to upgrade as well. So every building in the school system is going to have some maintenance or upgrade project completed. The high school being the biggest one is going to be a little over, projecting about over $15 million. Mm-hmm. And the middle school will be close to $7 million. The newer elementaries, Elliott and Eads, will be a little over $3 million. And then Frank Hammond will be just over, just a little over $5 million. And we've also put in about $8 million towards doing a major overhaul to our technology program.
Will you take a minute and go through especially the high school and the middle school, since you say those are the two largest of the capital projects?
Yeah, the high school, in and of itself, we've got, we want to, number one, secure the entrance to each of those buildings, because right now, when we do have people coming in, they're not really coming into a total secured area. So we want to increase the security when you walk into the entrance to the middle school and the high school. Mm-hmm. We want to we need to go through and we need to work on all the roof systems on both buildings, especially at the high school. We've got the field house that is in an extremely dire situation. That roof has not been replaced for over 20-some-odd years, so we are now looking at having to totally replace that, and I don't know exactly the total amount we're going to spend on that, but the last time they had an estimate a few years ago was over $750,000, so we know it could be close to $1 million just to fix that part of the roof, and it's in extremely terrible shape. We've got driveways and parking lots that have not been repaved. A lot of it's just been filling in potholes, but it's gotten to the point where we just really need to just redo the whole parking lots as well. And then, you know, We want to get into classrooms, and we want to work on the univentilator systems. They're old, and we feel like we can distribute the heat and the cooling differently in those rooms and not have noisy univentilators anymore. It'd be a quiet distribution of air. That way, the rooms heat better. They're more energy efficient. And a lot of these projects we're doing are going to be energy efficiency based. Just like this past summer when we put in the five new boilers in our energy center, they are all high-efficiency boilers. We're redoing the chillers over there now. And so everything is focused in on that. We're going to look at LED lighting, continue to put those systems in, the buildings, hallways, classrooms, trying to make the learning environments better for the kids.
I imagine that obviously you have done so, I'm sure, in talking with the school board about this. They're up to snuff on all of this now, and it's time to tell the public, if they are not aware of everything, is the fact that you've gone to, since 2014, I understand, was the last referendum that was put on the ballot, that you were able to receive some additional tax funds from residents. It's just time to be able to do the things that need to be done, and it's not because that you're being greedy necessarily. Certainly not the idea. You want to be as careful with the money that you have, but it's just that you're getting less money. You're getting less tax money coming in these days. Tell us about the problems that the school town of Munster is running into because of that.
Well, Chris, the capital projects for our district only comes to about $2 million. And when you start looking at what's paid out of that capital projects, we still pay a good portion of utilities out of that. We pay our technology out of that. We pay salaries and benefits to our maintenance staff out of that. And so it starts to deplete that fund that there's actually not enough dollars in there to just do basically maintenance projects over the years. You know, there's not a regular maintenance. And so we're limited by that. Along with that, because of pension bond debt we've had over the years, we have to, what they say is, we have to neutralize the pension bond debt we have been doing it with the capital projects, we've done it with transportation. But what that means is, whatever the increase or the tax rate is for the pension bond, we have to, whatever that percent is, we have to lower the other funds so that that becomes tax neutral. And so that has really impacted what we've done. And so really over the last several years, we've been doing a lot of band-aiding and duct taping and baling wire, a lot of things in our buildings, and not being able to really go back in and truly take out carpeting, fix carpeting, replace tile like we wanted to. We can only do small sections of the building. And like anybody who owns a house, you know that over a period of time, your carpet wears out, your roofs have to be replaced, your furnaces have to be replaced, your water heaters, you got to paint your walls at some point. So, you know, people just need to understand these buildings are old and they need to be maintained. And the capital projects doesn't provide the kinds of dollars we need in our district to maintain all of our buildings. And we don't just have five buildings, we have several. With the central office, with the maintenance buildings, and also the bus garage, and all the other buildings, the schools, you know, there's a lot of roofs, there's a lot of parking lots, and so we need to focus on getting those things fixed, getting them keeping them maintained, because we're talking about millions and millions of dollars in our buildings that we definitely can't afford to have them getting to the point where we want to start replacing buildings. And that's the one thing that this does not do. All it does is it focuses on fixing the current buildings that we have.
We're talking with School Town of Munster Superintendent Jeff Hendricks. The town Munster School District has received a tentative approval from the Lake County Board of Elections to be able to put a 50-word question on a special election ballot, which will tentatively come at least on May 2nd, to ask residents in Munster to support the changes that are needed in the taxing structure to be able to take care of these capital projects. And Dr. Hendricks, I understand, too, that it, besides being a point of pride, certainly for the school town of Munster, it's probably much one to the pride of the community as well, that they see their schools up to snuff and look as nice as they possibly could, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, part of that is that when people from outside our school corporation, outside of our community, want to look for schools to move into, you know, they're going to look at the facilities, they're going to look at the programs, and if you're a high-performing district like we are, that's attractive, but they also want to make sure that the facilities meet their needs as well. And what that does, I think, is it helps keep our property values up in our community, that because when we have people wanting to come in, we don't have a lot of properties for sale, so when people do put their properties up to be sold, they're getting a higher, I believe, they're getting a better return on their investment because their schools are in great shape. And so we just need to get those back up to speed. And you know, one of the things I want to point out, Chris, is this is not, we're not the first one out there to do that. We have listed numerous school corporations around us who have just won referendums on the capital side, who've been spending a lot of money. Valparaiso, one that comes to mind right away.
Oh, yeah.
Lake Central has done it. In fact, on our website, on our district transparency page, we have some frequently asked questions, and in there we actually talk about the different school corporations around us who have just won referendums on their capital, or and throughout the state, school corporations are having to use this vehicle or tool to help them catch up on a lot of particular areas in their buildings that they can't support through the current funding system we have now under capital projects.
Now, Dr. Hendricks, we had talked earlier here in our conversation about the fact that there is a dwindling tax revenue coming in because of the changes in how school districts are supported. It's all mainly by property taxes, and it's all being handled through the state. I understand, too, that you not only have this referendum that is on the question that is up on the ballot on May 2nd, but you may be asking, once you get approval for that, I suppose, too, to be able to get some additional help to deal with some operating costs as well. Tell us about the situation that the school town of Munster is in there, and how you're hoping that the patrons and the voters in Munster can help you out in that respect.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we are also going to be asking for an operating referendum as well. And again, part of the issues we've had over the years, the state has really not been able to provide as much funding as we would like to continue to support the programs and the personnel we have. We are struggling, like other districts, to attract good, high-quality teachers. To do that, you need to have competitive salaries, which for a while there, we've been one of the lowest starting salaries in the area. We just brought our starting salary up to $38,000, but it's still not the highest starting salary in the area. And we have struggled because we've dealt with a couple of tax appeals in our own community that impact us over $3 million. Mm-hmm. In 2020, we keep talking about what we call the fiscal cliff, but we have exempt debt that must come up back under the tax caps. And we're looking at $4 million of debt that has to come underneath that. So that's going to impact what we're doing. So we've had a lot of issues that we've been dealing with. Now, I will tell you, over the last 2.5 years since I've been on board, we have done a lot to save the school corporation $3.5 million. We have now gotten our expenditures under our revenue, but if we didn't have the current referendum, we would still be struggling because we would have had to reduce a lot more staffing and probably eliminated some programs. So that current referendum is helping us somewhat, but we feel that if we're going to go to the next step and to be competitive with other school corporations and continue to retain our great teachers we have here in the school town of Munster, attract new teachers, and continue to move our school corporation forward, get out of the current debt we have, and get some balances back in, that this referendum, these two referenda are going to help us move in that direction.
Well, Dr. Hendricks, we're looking forward to seeing this matter come up before the voters and the residents of Munster on the ballot on May 2nd. And I know that you have a lot of work between now and then in getting the word out and probably doing as much campaigning, almost as much as a political candidate might, in trying to not only support the school town of Munster, but also to show people in the community that these are all very worthwhile expenditures and they're very much worth everyone's support. It's going to be a good sell, I imagine, on your part and your colleagues' part, won't it?
Absolutely, because one of the things we want to stress is we do have a on our current Munster, School Town of Munster website. Mm-hmm. We do have a page called the District Transparency page, and we do have on that page frequently asked questions about the referendum. And so we've laid that out for folks, and we've got information out there about the projects, about the tax rates. One of the things that we have done, and they're going to see that the actual questions on the referenda, the ballots, are going to say something like, you're going to be asked to pay 43 cents or 42 cents or 25 cents per hundred. But what we need to get people to understand is we're actually only looking at, because of the way we have structured the payments, we're looking at about 9 cents per hundred on everyone's taxes for both referendum together. And we have presentations from Umball and Associates, a certified public accountants firm that has done those projections. We have a couple of of PowerPoint presentations on there by Umbaugh that shows exactly how this is going to be funded and what it's going to cost the taxpayer. So I know that people get alarmed when they see 43 cents or 25 cents, but we have been able to structure it based off the debt we have to show that it's going to have an impact of about 9 cents per hundred is what we're estimating at this point. And these are just estimates because there's too many factors involved, but we're looking at what we know right now. We're projecting at about 9 cent increase starting in 2018.
Well, Dr. Hendricks, I know this it seems like an awful lot to take on, but as you mentioned, that with all of the projects that need to be done in the school town of Munster, not only dealing with the physical plant, so to speak, the school buildings and the like, starting out from the elementary schools all the way up to the high school, but you've got also the operating costs that you know you're trying to be able to reach to keep in line, knowing that revenues are going to drop in the future. It seems like an awful lot to bring up before the voters at one particular time, but it's all structured there. It's on the School Town of Munster website, and we wish you the best, and thank you for spending the last 16 minutes or so talking about this. This is a lot to bring up, I know, but we really appreciate you taking time to lay it out in detail, and we hope that we'll have a chance to be back with you here between now and the special election plan for May 2nd to talk more about it. We really appreciate you talking today with us.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. I'm glad to be here, and yes, I'm sure we will talk again.
Not long ago, executives from the Northwest Indiana Forum got together with members of the Northwest Indiana legislative delegation and members of the forum down in Indianapolis to talk about some of the ideas that the forum has they'd like to see lawmakers work on in this legislative session underway. And with us to talk more about it, we have the Northwest Indiana Forum's Chief Executive Officer, Heather Ennis. Heather, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a very, very ambitious set of projects that lawmakers have overall that they're dealing with this time around. And I know for sure that the Northwest Indiana Forum has their eyes and their sights set in particular on infrastructure. Tell us what the forum would like to see done this legislative session.
Yeah, so our top two legislative priorities involve infrastructure, first being the double tracking of the South Shore Rail Line. You know, that investment is long overdue for our existing rail line, so we're excited to see that potentially come to fruition. There's a couple of bills out there that participate in funding of that, and we're going to be downstate advocating that those move forward. That has an opportunity to be transformational in our region to double track that line and expedite the time into the city of Chicago. It's, you know, we're very fortunate to be a stone's throw away from the third largest economy in the country, and the more we can connect to that, the better off it'll be for our local residents and attracting talent to our region. So we're excited about that. We're also, our second legislative agenda item is infrastructure as a whole. So we support House Bill 1002, which is Representative Soliday's bill, talking about long-term planning and funding for infrastructure projects. You know, we have continually operated on less money than we need in order to sustain our infrastructure, let alone advance it forward to be a continued player in the market. And when you're the crossroads of America, your infrastructure gets quite a workout. So we really need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep that infrastructure strong and to continue to build on it.
Now, I know that one of the ideas that's been talked about here, of course, one of the ideas that the lawmakers will most likely take up will be increasing the state's gasoline tax. They see it as a necessary evil because the vehicles on the roads are using less gasoline. They're more efficiently using gasoline. And we also find, too, that we have electrical vehicles that are out there. We don't have the gasoline uses as we used to have, so the gasoline tax revenues don't come in like they used to.
Right. And, you know, as the CAFE standards get more in place, those fuel efficiency standards are going to be even higher. So we're going to continue to see people utilizing less gas. So in 1002, there are some additional fees that would be for electric vehicles and other things like that that help to mediate some of that. So I think, you know, obviously it's a changing world, and the way we've funded road infrastructure hasn't changed to keep up with the times. So this is really a bill to help move us into what we're seeing from a product standpoint of what is utilizing the roads in today's economy.
We're talking with Heather Ennis, who's the CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum. They had a chance to talk with the Northwest Indiana Legislative Delegation and other people recently to offer their feelings, priorities that they'd like to see the General Assembly take during this current session. And I know there's some other things on the big Northwest Indiana Forum list that you would like to see taken care of as well. Some have to do with workforce development, and some have to do with looking into the future of businesses, especially the biosciences businesses. Tell us where the forum is standing on those ideas.
Yeah, so, you know, workforce development is critical to existing business as well as business that we want to attract. So whatever we can do to help train our workforce helps us to be stronger for growth of our existing businesses as well as bringing in new companies to the area. So we really think it's important for businesses to also be able to train their incumbent workers. So oftentimes, we're incentivized to train for new jobs, but keeping our current workforce trained and helping the companies that are here to grow and flourish by being able to bring on new talent to their existing workforce is important as well. So that's something that we've advocated for this year and will continue to push forward. I know it's important to our companies that are here as well as companies that might look to locate here.
Mm-hmm.
Also, continually economic development incentives come under attack. So we're working tirelessly to make sure that we keep our sandbox as happy and healthy as any sandbox out there for attracting investment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we only have a certain amount of tools to do that, and usually that's done through TIF or local incentives of tax abatement and things of that nature. And oftentimes the legislature tends to frown on some of those TIF infrastructure or TIF financing opportunities. And so we want to make sure that those incentives are protected, and we'll be advocating for that as well.
No, the Purdue University Northwest Bioscience Innovation Building is one of the buildings on the Hammond campus that the university would like to see put up. And, of course, they've got to get approval from the General Assembly for the funding for that as well before it even goes to the State Commission for Higher Education to look at it. And then, of course, other state agencies have to sign off on the idea of having this new construction. And I understand the Northwest Indiana Forum is right behind them looking for support.
Absolutely, Chris. So you know, that over $40 million infrastructure project that Purdue Northwest is looking at doing is exactly what we need in order to, you know, as we were talking about, training a talented workforce. Those job opportunities are the future job opportunities, and whatever we can do to train a talented workforce in those fields right here at home is critically important. So we're really excited about this opportunity, and we think that this is a project that should be moved forward. We've spoken with the legislature about it, and we'll continue to advocate along with the folks from Purdue Northwest to make that building a reality.
Heather, I also know, too, that the Northwest Indiana Forum is also continuing to be very, very supportive of this coalition that is looking into ways to improve U.S. 30. U.S. 30 is a major pipeline for not only commerce, but for people getting to and from the shopping districts, wherever it happens to be, whether it's here in Lake County or if it's over in Porter County in Valparaiso. It's all connected, seems to be, on U.S. 30. And we have, you don't have to travel many times on U.S. 30 to realize it is a very, very congested way to get around. And there must be some way to do some improvements to it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And so there's been a coalition that's been built around U.S. 30 and hosting those conversations. You know, the opportunity, I don't think that anybody really realized that the strength that opportunity had until we saw what happened with 31. Mm-hmm. And as the improvement happened on 31, the mindset around the U.S. 30 coalition continues to gain momentum, because watching the way that 31's transformed really has opportunity to do the same thing in the east-west corridor of 30. So we're excited about that opportunity. We know that it's probably still a ways out, but again, something that we want to keep on our agenda and keep in the forefront of people's minds.
Now, during your discussions with the Northwest Indiana legislative delegation, even though it's very, very early in the legislative session, they certainly are interested, and I'm sure they probably offered their ideas with their feelings as to whether some of these initiatives are going to make it through the session or not, have they?
You know, certainly all bills have been filed, so there are great opportunities. As I was saying, we've got a couple of bills out there that are already talking about the double tracking of the South Shore. The infrastructure bills are out there and getting hearings here in the next week. And so we'll be down with a Northwest Indiana delegation talking about these things and trying to make sure that we help move them forward.
We've been talking with Northwest Indiana Forum Chief Executive Officer Heather Ennis. They had a chance to talk with state lawmakers not long ago about the ideas that the Northwest Indiana Forum would like to push during this current legislative session. Heather, thanks for being with us, and I'm sure we'll get updates here as you have a chance to get updates from the state lawmakers as well, too. Thank you for being with us today.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
More Lake County communities are getting involved in the county's composting operation. Solid Waste Management District Executive Director John Manier told me after last week's meeting that work is underway on a site in Crown Point, and the town of Highland will soon have a formal composting operation that can serve several towns.
The programs are going very well. This last fall season, we had a lot more leaves than what we've had in the past. We probably went over by about 2,000 yards from prior years, but our space capacity is going really well. The material's breaking down actually very well. We plan on doing some screening at our Gary site and getting ready for hopefully a spring sell of some finished compost. So things are going well. We are currently working on our registration for the City of Crown Point's site. We hope to get that one ready to go by this fall. Get last year's material put into windrows and be ready for the fall.
Now, where was Crown Point site going to be located?
It's located at their sewer plant. It's a location where they had taken leaves before and then switched to some locations out in the country. And now we're going to actually build a facility out there, put some grindings down like we have done at the Gary site and make that facility usable.
Okay, tell us about Highland, since that's the latest one to be added to the mix, or will be eventually when things move along in there.
Yeah, Highland's actually an exciting site because its location is really perfect. There's not a whole lot around there other than the interstate. But there have been wood waste material that have been taken there before, and it's actually at their old landfill site. So we're going to be doing some work out there, getting the site ready to accept, hopefully, leaves in the 2018 season. The nice thing about that site is it's close enough to Munster, who's taking their leaves out to Gary. That will end up saving them some transportation and potentially even the town of Dyer, depending on, you know, what they want to do. So that site has the opportunity to save communities some money provide some positive material for us and potentially even do some food waste, because there's a local business out there that's approached us with some of their material. It's very organic, and it's not, you know, it's a vegetable organic material, so it would work in well with the material.
One of the things I know that had been talked about in the past, and you'd mentioned earlier in your plans going into 2017, was to continue on the goal of zero waste. What's the status of that project right now?
Well, as I told the board, our focus is putting together all of our business templates, our plan, how we're going to implement that on the residential, commercial, and business sectors. We're looking at talking to some of the local universities and doing some partnerships there. So 2017 is going to be kind of our planning and development years, and then 2018 will begin with the actual implementation of what we develop this year. So we're calling the program A Journey to Zero, because it's going to be just that. It's going to be a journey. We're not going to get there. We're not even setting a date of when we're going to get there. We're just going to work really hard each year at continuing to put in better purchasing practices, better management practice of material, better ways to recycle, more efficient ways, and get communities thinking about possibly doing better diversions. And there's a lot of opportunities with some of our local businesses that people aren't aware of. So when we get our new website developed, which we hope to have finished by this spring, all of those businesses that currently offer some kind of recycling, we're going to add them to our list so people will know in their area where they can recycle their oils, where they can recycle their clothes, where they can recycle their wood, where they can recycle, you know, whatever they're generating from their home, sometimes drywall or a host of materials. So we're looking at developing some of those partnerships. And so in 2018, we hope to be able to hit the ground running with that program.
Now, since Zero Waste is a pretty ambitious project in itself, obviously the state is coming back to try to revamp its standards and in turn to reduce the amount of waste statewide that's going into landfills across Indiana. Have you had a chance to talk with the people at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management about what the Zero Waste program is all about to let them know, to keep them in the loop, so to speak?
Yes, we've been down to Indianapolis and talked to them. We actually had talked to Governor Pence, now Vice President-elect Pence, his staff, when we began to look at the implementation of this. So the folks down at the state are aware that our board did pass a resolution adopting a zero waste strategy in 2016, and they kind of know what our timeline is. I'm going down February to do a presentation on our zero waste and our composting operations there.
Do the folks at IDM seem to be interested in what you're doing, at least what they know right now?
Yeah, they're very excited about it. From what I understand, we're one of the first districts in the state of Indiana to actually adopt a zero waste strategy. There's a lot of universities around the state. Indiana's been doing some stuff with Indiana University's been doing some zero waste. I think Butler has been doing some stuff, IUPUI. So there's a lot of activity with the universities doing this.
Well, you also have the Subaru Automotive facility in Lafayette, too, that we already know is already at zero waste.
Yeah, exactly. The business communities have been leading the charge on doing this because there's potentially some strong financial incentives for them. So we're encouraged by what we're seeing, the trends going, and at least from a community standpoint, we're a little bit out in front of that trend going in Indiana. But we believe that there's going to be more and more people that will get involved and start adopting zero waste strategies. The goal right now is set by the legislature at 50%. But again, we believe that the trend is going to be to adopt programs that focus on zero waste. We just want to go ahead and start the process now, and who knows when we'll get there, but we're going to keep fighting and keep working towards it.
That's Lake County Solid Waste Management District Director John Manier looking toward an ambitious goal of zero waste going into the landfills here in the region. And we spoke after the latest Board of Directors meeting where the members approved a resolution to work with Crown Point frozen food processor Van Drunen Farms to compost the company's pre-consumer food waste at the Gary composting site. And the board also chose Tredabe to run the county's household solid waste collection program for the next 3 years. The cost will be just over half of what it cost the county under its previous arrangement with the multi-county Lake Michigan District. Lake Porter and LaPorte County officials agreed to dissolve their interlocal agreement on a joint household hazardous waste operation with the Lake Michigan District at the end of 2016. Hundreds of anti-Trump protesters flooded the streets around the Porter County Courthouse in Valparaiso this past weekend to make their feelings known. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports that they say the liberal agenda has more support than people in Washington realize, and the more than 500 protesters that showed up is proof.
The Women's March in Valparaiso is deliberately loud. They want to make sure that people can hear them, especially those in Washington in the new Trump administration and in Congress. They carry signs in all shapes and sizes with messages about their demands. Some say things like save Social Security, equal rights for women, marriage equality, save our schools, and simply resist.
A lot of our rights are potentially being violated, and I'm very concerned about that, especially health care and the income of senior citizens.
Equality for all and health care for women, completely and totally.
Messages here is that we're standing in solidarity with all women's marches in this country and the nation and the world today, and hope that all these issues that have been brought up and expressed by these wonderful people will give notice to Washington of what really is important.
What's your concern about schools?
I'm concerned that they're going to take away the public schools to the point where they'll become ineffectual in our families and with our children, and that these charter schools would be nothing but for-profit organizations.
That's so bad?
I don't believe that a for-profit organization teaches openly. I think they will restrict what they're teaching to what makes them money.
The official count from organizers was somewhere north of 500 people. Throughout the crowd, people were wearing pink cat-eared hats called vagina hats. They actually call them something different. It starts with a P and ends with a Y.
Oh, well, I made my hats this morning, made it for my mom and I. This is, we're coming out here to support. I am a teacher, and I firmly believe that we need to stand up, we need to speak, we need to support women's rights, human's rights. So that's why we're out here today.
I'm here for the same thing. I also have a gay son, so I'm here for the LGBTQ community as well.
Well, I think it has a little bit to do with a certain person who said that you could just reach out and grab them by the... So sort of in solidarity with women folk everywhere, we're representing for the...
Charlotte Freeland is the organizer of the march. Among Charlotte's issues is health care.
I'm a two-time breast cancer survivor, and I can tell you that going through chemo, when your white blood cell count bottoms out and you have to have a shot of Neulasta, I was shocked when I got the bill, $3,250 for one shot, one injection, and I had seven. So
and
if we didn't
be able to do that because of health care.
Right. If we had no health insurance whatsoever, I would be living on the street in a tent.
These marchers say their efforts will not end here. They plan to stand up, speak up, and resist. In Valparaiso, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The Indiana Department of Education is currently investigating 85 educators for misconduct. Of those 85, about 40 involve at least an allegation, if not charges, of sexual or inappropriate contact with a student. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballin and Rosen reports that some lawmakers want more background checks on school staff. Others wonder if it'll be enough.
It's not hard to see the problem, says State Senator Dennis Cruz.
Teachers and employees at public schools and other schools, for that matter, are having wrongful relationships with the students.
There have been highly publicized cases. In 2016, a basketball coach at a well-respected private school in Indianapolis pled guilty to coercing a 15-year-old into exchanging sexually explicit messages. The same year, an investigation by USA Today gave Indiana an F in screening teachers.
We want to try to develop some new legislation here that'll help address that and try to stop it.
Cruz chairs the Indiana Legislature's House Committee on Education. While districts do give new employees background checks within 3 months of starting, that law took effect in 2009. So plenty of teachers, cafeteria staff, school aides hired before then have never had a background check. Cruz wants to change the law so all employees get background checks every 5 years.
After a period of 5 years, things may have happened in your life and you may have made some wrong decisions and got in trouble and the school doesn't know about it.
Each time, employees would be checked for criminal history and allegations in and out of state. Over at the Department of Education, Kelly Bowder is a department staff attorney.
One of my main responsibilities is to work on teacher license suspensions and revocations.
Since 2013, the department has revoked 48 licenses for misconduct. All 48 were initially investigated for sex offenses, like child seduction, sexual misconduct with a minor, child molestation. 13 eventually pled to a lesser offense or were not charged with a sex crime. For example, things like sexting aren't necessarily criminal.
We get a lot of cases that we see that didn't rise to the level of being charged criminally, but were inappropriate, and sexting is probably one of the biggest ones that I get.
Bowder says still, extending background checks is a good first step. But the Education Department isn't counting on lawmakers to fix the problem.
we don't wait here at the department for the legislature to tell us that we should be doing things.
She says prevention measures, like trainings around ethical and professional behavior, are more important than checking somebody's past.
The majority of the cases that I see are people without any prior criminal history.
Meaning background checks wouldn't have stopped them from getting into schools in the first place. And while the proposed legislation would check all employees, each district would still make its own rules for volunteers, including some coaches. And that concerns the department, because Bowder says if a volunteer coach is let go for sexual misconduct but not charged with a crime, he or she could get a job elsewhere and still have no criminal record.
Until someone takes responsibility for it and is willing to require that coaches have a license that could be revoked so they can't move from school to school, that will be a continuing problem that the department simply can't address if they're not a licensed teacher as well.
Now, some districts do require background checks for volunteers. Jeff Hendricks, head of Indiana Association of Public School Superintendents, says there's no statewide standard, though. Individual districts make their own policies.
You know, if they're paid by the school corporation, they're going to have the check. If they're coaches or volunteers, we have done in the past limited criminal history checks on them as well.
None of the three background check bills currently being reviewed by Senate and House committees on education include volunteers. It'd still be up to individual schools and districts. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. For someone with depression, finding an antidepressant that works is by trial and error, and it often takes weeks or months. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lita Noon reports, new research and genetic tests are starting to help doctors personalize the search for the right medication.
In the ER, not long after Prozac came on the market in the late 1980s, she discovered the medication tremendously helped her depression.
I had a friend that I worked with who was taking it, and I said, dang, I mean, we were at the emergency room, and I said, I want to feel like you. I said, you are handling things so well, you know, because sometimes you're overwhelmed, and you just want to walk out for a while, you know, and you can't.
Northam stayed on Prozac for years, paying out of pocket for the name brand because she thinks generics don't work as well. When she retired, she could no longer afford the $450 a month, so she tried a generic but wasn't happy with the results. When her physician retired, her new doctor put her on Lexapro. It helped only a little, she says, at first.
I was short-tempered with my grandkids, my kids, too. I mean, it just came out of the blue. That's not good. And that was not me.
As her depression worsened, Northam found herself thinking about suicide, something she says she would never seriously consider because of her family. Then, when Northam had to change doctors again, she found a new ally in her fight against depression.
I'm Beth Buchanan. I'm a family practice physician. I've been in practice over 30 years.
Buchanan practices in Shelbyville and recently learned about pharmacogenomics, or DNA testing, to help rule in or out the best antidepressants for an individual.
It's totally about metabolism, and I want to be clear that it doesn't predict what medicine will work well for you. It doesn't predict efficacy, but it might explain lack of efficacy.
Northam took the test, and the results came back showing Lexapro isn't a good genetic match. She doesn't metabolize it well. So she and Buchanan agreed to try one from the list her body would metabolize. They once again tried a generic version of Prozac. This time, it's working. And she's grateful for the test.
If nothing else, I think it takes away that trial and error because you don't have time for that. Once you start that downhill slide, you don't have time, you know, because it's going to get worse.
Northam's metabolism test helped rule out drugs that wouldn't work. But what if doctors could accurately pinpoint those that would?
My name is John Nernberger, and I'm a professor of psychiatry here at Indiana University School of Medicine. I've been working in the area of psychiatric genetics for about 40 years.
Nernberger says clinical trials with Assurex, the company that created the genetic test Northam used, are underway now at IU. And part of the study is to determine from a genetic standpoint which drugs will best treat an individual patient's depression.
They've also added in what we call some pharmacodynamic measures. And the pharmacodynamic measures are not so much how the body metabolizes the drug, but how the body responds to the drug. That is what the receptors do and how the drug interacts with receptors in the brain.
Andy says Biosurex and other companies refining the genetic tests, there's hope even more of the trial and error in prescribing antidepressants will go away, hastening relief for people like Jan Northam. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee DeNoon, Indianapolis.
Well, this Monday, it's time for Eye on the Arts with John Kane of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is a frequent guest, Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Hey, Kirk.
Hi, Happy New Year, John.
Yeah, same to you. Same to you. We had quite a success with our Holiday Pops concert.
Oh, boy. I just saw Matt, the station manager here, head of TV, and he said he'd never seen so many people at the Star Theater.
It was just packed.
It was
completely
packed.
It was a wonderful experience. People really loved it. But now life goes on, sadly, after that huge triumph. And now, but it's still our 75th anniversary season. It barrels on. We're still getting – people are joining our 75th club like crazy.
75 for 75.
$75.
$7,500.
Or $7,500. We have so far one of those members. But many, 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 many $75 members of our 75th anniversary club. And you get to come to the big blowout party at the end of the season on April 27th. But in the meantime, we have a classical concert for Valentine's Day.
We do. February the 10th, Friday night, 7:30. There'll be a very entertaining pre-concert talk at 6:15, which I will give with videos. And Yana, our pianist, is coming.
Oh, good.
And actually, John...
she's that beautiful woman, right?
Yeah, beautiful Russian monster pianist. And also Kevin, our tuba player, has agreed to come to the pre-concert talk and talk about circular breathing.
Oh, good Lord.
Where you just
never
don't
heard of such a thing.
You don't stop playing. You take a breath, and then you use the air in your mouth to keep playing while you're breathing in.
Wow!
So you can play like a note for 3 minutes, and he's going to do it for us. And plus, he's such an interesting guy. So that's some of the pre-concert.
Kevin's
talk.
One of those musicians who's a whole section unto himself.
He is, and he's a wonderful guy. His brass quintet is really taking off in all of America.
Oh, wonderful.
But Yana, you were talking about Yana. Yana, I use the word monster. She's a Russian pianist who now lives with her husband in Chicago, and she's playing chamber music with all of the musicians in the CSO, all the musicians at Lyric, and she just eats the piano. She is an astonishing pianist and very, very interesting human being.
What was the last performance she gave for us?
She hasn't yet.
Oh, okay.
Yes, you probably are thinking of some things that you've seen online that we sent to Tammy and Donna just recently.
You know, my Russian is sort of limited to Boris and Natasha, so I think I have her confused with that other beautiful Russian pianist we had play the Rachmaninoff.
Oh, yes, yes.
That was the first year we were at Bethel, I think.
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Well, so my memory does not serve me.
That's fine. That's fine. And Yana knows every Russian, every Lithuanian, every Latvian, every Polish person, I think, in Chicagoland. And she's played over here on the Munster community series.
Has she?
Yeah.
Okay.
She has a huge fan base. And
good.
I know people are going to love her. And this exotic Nights in the Garden of Spain that that Defia wrote about the castle of Alhambra and the Yasmin Gardens. And it's very exotic and beautiful and different than the other music on the program, but I think pretty romantic, actually.
Yeah. Well, and our piano concerts always sell well.
Yes.
And we have the piano cam.
Yes, we will have the piano cam for about the last 3 minutes directly on Yana so that you can see everything that she's doing.
That's fantastic. So what else what else can I embarrass myself trying to talk about?
Oh, do you want to get into Gotodammerung and the Wagner Siegfried's Rhine journey?
Sure. You can just take it away.
So in contrast to this very impressionistic Spanish music, we have Siegfried's Rhine journey, which is a very beautiful, gorgeous piece of Wagner about Siegfried going forth to do goodly deeds for his beautiful Brunhilde. And it's just a gorgeous piece of music that shows the orchestra off and very romantic in a German, you know, Siegfried's Rhine journey kind of way. You wake up at dawn. He goes out on his horse to do good.
Schmetterling.
Schmetterling. You like Schmetterling, butterfly?
And how do you say ambulance? Krankenwagen.
Krankenwagen. Yes. Yeah. But it's okay. We just have, there's no singing or anything. Yeah. And then we're going to do the Dawn of Diana Overture, which is fun Czech music, which is Sergeant Preston of the Yukons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And,
in honor of your Canadian roots.
My Canadian roots, yes. And, and also the Dvorak 8th Symphony, which is one of the just most listenable, easy, yummy, delicious pieces of romantic, you know, music that you can imagine.
Well, that kind of brings us to the end of our time, but I want to thank you for being here to tell us about the concert. I'm certainly looking forward to it. I will be there.
Yes.
And I hope everybody else is too.
And cookies with Kirk after.
And cookies with Kirk afterwards. What a perfect Valentine treat. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
This is John Kane, host of Eye on the Arts, talking with Kirk Muspratt about the 75th anniversary of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. You can hear Eye on the Arts on Mondays here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.